Spirit Radio Podcasts.
The protests in Hong Kong moved to a new level on Tuesday when teenage student Tsang Chiking was shot by police using live ammunition, as in not, you know, not a baton round, not a rubber bullet. But meanwhile in Beijing, 70 years after Communist Party rule, were celebrated with a show of military strength and a declaration by President Xi Jinping that no force can shake the status of this great nation. It was rather interesting as well. He was attired in very much in Chairman Mao gear as well, which I'm sure sent a very powerful signal out there. On the line to comment on these events, we have a man who has spent time in both China and Hong Kong, David Aikman, former Time Magazine foreign correspondent. You're very welcome back to the show, David. How are you?
Thank you very much, Ronan. It's great to be on again.
So first of all, David, what were your impressions of the National Day ceremonies in Beijing?
Well, the National Day celebrations were a rerun of the 1935 Nuremberg Nazi celebrations of great power in Germany. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen such a grotesque demonstration of military might, marching women, soldiers parading behind these incredible new drones and guided missiles. It was a very sinister display of military might, basically concocted by the Communist Party with China sort of showing up to applaud and watch. It was a hideous display, I think, of great political power by the Communist Party posing as the Chinese nation.
I agree with you, David. You know, one of the things that I've noticed growing up was that over the years, China were becoming more and more powerful, no doubt. And then they became, you know, they started to, if you remember, they were lending an awful lot of money to the US in the kind of 90s and noughties. And then they were kind of, they were like the factory for the whole world. And all the time, really playing down, in some respects, their power. You know, they were kind of like almost trying to say, don't look at us, there's nothing to see here. And all of a sudden, there's this, as you say, this really almost grotesque show of power out of nowhere. What is that about?
Well, they played along for 30 years with the Americans. Oh, we're just a developing country. All we want to do is to modernize. And please give us as much help as you can. And by the way, we'll steal your intellectual property
Sure.
if you don't give it to us. And all of a sudden, they have emerged as a self-confident, proud national state, basically goaded on by the Communist Party itself. I mean, Chinese nationalism is Communist Party self-glorification wrapped in the Chinese flag, and that is what was protested against most strongly by the Hong Kong protesters. I think Tuesday's demonstration was extraordinary in that most of the demonstrators were not demonstrating anymore against the Hong Kong government's legal business, but they were protesting against the Chinese Communist Party itself, equating it with Hitler's Germany. I mean, it was an amazing change of point of view.
Absolutely. And why would you think, I mean, you know, and we all know, those, I'm sure more than yourself, we've all noticed that what's been going on in the South China Sea, and there's been this kind of spread of influence, and they've been pretty bullying to their neighbours like the Philippines and stuff. And this is just, these stories have just been sneaking into the headlines, not very much, you know, but they're there. Why would they choose this particular moment to just go, look at us, we've got, it wasn't just, we have money, we have military power, we're, you know, we're really, it was frightening in some respects.
Well, it is, because they've got a plan to take over the whole world by 2049.
Seriously?
Yes, absolutely. It's a 100-year marathon. Read a book by Michael Pillsbury called The 100-Year Marathon War, China's attempt to replace the United States as a global hegemon by 2049. And incredible detail goes into that. They've got the basically the 20th decade of this century, their plan to impose Chinese technology as a leader in the world. By 2030s, they hope to have completely wrapped up everybody else's finance. By 2049, they are going to be in military parity with the United States. or, as they hope, in excess of the United States. So they really do want to control the world.
Wow. I often think when it comes to these kind of, and they are empires, I suppose, if you think of it, that the Lord always has something to do there. He always steps in some way.
Yes. Well, I don't think they're going to succeed, because I think they're going to break up before that happens, just as the Soviet Union broke up, even at the point when many in the West feared that they were becoming even more powerful than they actually were. And I think that's going to be the case with China too.
And meanwhile, the day was marked by protests in Hong Kong that turned violent. And I was just saying earlier on, I wondered if to some degree, at least in the West, Hong Kong really destroys the PR of the day, you know, that China was trying
Absolutely.
To create.
It did. I mean, the Chinese don't like to lose face. And the Chinese Communist Party hates to have anybody publicly making fun of them. And that's what happened in Hong Kong. I mean, the protesters said, well, we're no longer fussy about the one country, two systems program. We just don't like the Chinese Communist Party, and we're going to say so. We don't think you should be in charge.
Wow. That's very confrontational, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to end, unfortunately, in a fairly bloody mess, maybe not as violent as the 1989 Tiananmen student massacre, but something pretty bad.
And I'm thinking about that, and I know that you wrote extensively about it at the time, but the victims of the Tiananmen Square massacre were kind of almost erased from memory in some ways.
Yes, there's a wonderful book called The People's Republic of Amnesia by an American journalist who set out to explore exactly how the regime had managed to erase any trace or historical evidence for what had happened. And it's a fascinating story.
I was going to say that, you know, I'm wondering if this particular group will be as easy to erase, because they've been so clever at using, you know, at using the media, at using social media to get the message out there. And like they've created memes, you know, that go out beyond, like even kids in the West are using these memes of, you know, make like water and all the stuff that they say about, you know, being just, it would be very, very difficult for, I mean, they obviously the Communist Party could come in and could do Tiananmen Square and put them in jail, but it'd be hard to erase the memory of them.
Well, for the time being, yes, but if you consider that 1989 was a very bloodthirsty massacre of thousands of people, and yet they swept that successfully under the carpet over a period of 20 or 30 years. So their determination to avoid telling the truth has not lessened in the last few decades.
Sure. What do you think then, David, is the Chinese Communist government's strategy on Hong Kong? They seem to be keeping their powder dry. They seem to be staying back at the border. But do you think they're going to overrun the place eventually?
Well, I'm sure they will, because they have complete sovereign control, and they have all the manpower they need to absolutely crush any rebellious spirits in Hong Kong. But they have to be a little bit careful, because Hong Kong is still very important to them as an entrepot to get Western capital and especially dollars into China. And they don't want to make the situation so bad that lots of big corporations and banks are simply going to get up and leave. I mean, already you've had the exodus of several tycoons to Singapore and Taiwan, because they don't want to put up with this stuff.
Yeah, and I keep forgetting, of course, that the HSBC Bank is Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation. So it's like that is effectively. I know it has its fingers and toes in everywhere all over the world, but really it comes from there. And would you say there's a kind of a sense in which they also, like you made that point of the idea that they would finance the world, and I remember many years ago reading about the fact that in the poorest poorest parts of China, even the poorest parts of China, somebody would earn a euro a day, or a euro a week, or 2 euro a week, and put one of them into the bank. So actually, they had this enormous amount of capital that they could spend and spread around the world. And yet now, it looks like they're hitting a kind of, because of the trade war, they're hitting a kind of a recession themselves.
They are, yes. I mean, they're being really squeezed by President Trump's pressure on them, and they are at the moment losing the trade war with the United States, and I think they're going to suffer seriously in economic terms. But they still have power. The Communist Party still controls Beijing and the rest of the country. But for how long will that last? That's going to be the interesting question of the next few years.
Absolutely. David Ekman, always a joy to speak with you, and so interesting, so many insights. Author and former Time Magazine senior correspondent David Ekman, thank you so much for talking
thank
to us this
Ron.
Morning. God bless
thank
you. Bye-bye. Cattle rustling. It sounds like the stuff of the Wild West, but it's happening in Ireland today. This week, the Irish Farmers Journal reported that cattle worth 1 million euro have been stolen from Irish farms over the last time. And this has an emotional as well as a financial cost for farming families. And on the line now, we have the journalist who broke the story, Barry Cassidy. You're very welcome to the show, Barry. How are you?
Not so bad, no, not so bad.
So first of all, Barry, how big a problem is this?
I mean, you've called out the figures there, really. I mean, the 1 million really catches your eye, doesn't
it? It's massive. And you're talking about over the last number of years, is it?
Yeah, so I suppose that's taken over the last 10 years. And what we see with this issue really is it seems to flare up and down. You know, last year we seen 130 odd go missing. The year before that it was 50. So, I mean, it's not something that there's a consistent amount, but it does from time to time seem to flare up.
Yeah, and I mean, you'll have to forgive me here, Barry, being a townie, I don't know what a million quid of cattle looks like. I mean, what in terms of head of cattle, are you talking about hundreds? Are you talking about thousands? What you know?
Yeah, so the exact figure we have is 2,222 cattle.
That's
and I mean, that million, you could even call that a conservative estimate. I mean, we put a value of 500 euro per animal on that. But I mean, some of these animals could have been worth up to 1,200, 1,300 in value.
Right,
And then there was other ones, you know, there was cows taken with calves at foot. For a farmer, it's not only the cost of that cow and the cost of the calf. I mean, that cow is the cornerstone of the business, and when she's gone, she's gone.
Yeah.
And it can take a long time to replace that.
Absolutely. And, you know, are you talking about, you know, people breaking into sheds or taking them out of fields? I mean, what way does this happen?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's highly organised for a start. I mean, this isn't a case of someone, you know, looking over a hedge into a field and seeing some cattle and pulling up and taking them. No, farms are selected. They pick their targets carefully, they're watched for a number of days. And then, you know, these crimes often, they happen late at night, early in the morning, when there's no one around to see what's happening. But it's a mix of what happens. I mean, sometimes they're taken from fields, and these fields will be located away from the farmer's house and the farmer's actual, where his main business might happen. And people will know that, and that's why those fields are selected. It'll happen to out farms as well, so... I mean, one issue that's definitely raised is coming into the winter, this flares up more because it's much easier to take an animal when it's housed in a shed than when it's out in the field.
Right, it's easier to round it up as such, is it?
Yeah, I mean, look, we heard of one story of a farmer had cattle out in a field and the thieves were coming for a number of days beforehand, before taking the cattle and feeding the animals themselves. I mean, the thieves were feeding the animals so that when they finally came to take them, they nearly walked straight onto the trailer for them and they could get away even quicker.
Gosh, look, there's massive research there.
Yeah, I mean, look, that just shows you how organised the whole thing is. I mean, as I said, they picked their target and for a number of days beforehand, they were putting the groundwork in place to be able to carry out their theft.
And what, I mean, obviously you're talking about outlying farms and fields that are away from, you know, but are there particular areas of the country that are more affected than others or is it everywhere?
Yeah, look, I mean, the figures we've seen there, it's very, very obvious when you look at the map of where this is happening. You're talking Monaghan is the worst affected.
Wow.
I mean, 15% of all total thefts happen there. Louth is also quite high, 130 animals alone there. Meath also is quite high. So there seems to be a pocket of activity there.
Something about the border? I don't know.
Yeah, look, the border has been implicated, and we have figures from the north as well. And I mean, they've had 535 incidences of theft in the last 5 years. So, I mean, this isn't an issue of, say, cattle being taken and brought up north. I mean, there's cattle being taken in the north too.
Yeah.
It's happening on both sides of the border.
And have authorities been able to address this problem, or is it fairly piecemeal? Is it like, you know, the way you're describing it, it sounds like there's a system at work here. Are they treating it like that, or are they just doing it on a crime-by-crime basis?
Yeah, I mean, like, the figures talk for themselves. I mean, 2,202 animals taken, just 81 recovered in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a rate of less than 4% recovery.
Yeah.
So, you know, these cattle are, they're nearly, as one farmer put it, he said, they disappear off the face of the earth, and the farmer is left feeling helpless.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what is that like for somebody who, I mean, first of all, financially, it must be devastating, but even on a just personal, emotional, psychological level, it must really shake you.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I heard one story of a farmer who, an elderly man, and his cattle were taken. And I mean, the cost of the theft alone cost him 20,000. I mean, for a farm, that's a massive, massive hit.
Yeah.
But not only that, that farmer is elderly. His mental health is affected in that. He spoke about how he felt unsafe and not confident to put cattle back to where they'd been taken from.
Yeah.
I mean, that's land he'd been renting, so he's had to let that land go. And as a result, his business is less viable now. I mean, that kind of incident has nearly forced him to retire from what he was doing.
So clearly you've been talking directly to farmers and their families yourself.
Yeah, I mean, look, we can talk about the figures all we want, you know, and there is massive figures there, but I suppose it's on a case-by-case, on the personal basis, that's when it really hits you, just how much one of these incidents can mean to a farm.
What was your sense, Barry, did you feel when you were talking to them that any of them were targeted for personal rather than for purely, you know, if I may say, business reasons?
I mean, look, I suppose it varied across them. I mean, one guy, his farm even, it wasn't a case of it was an easy target. I mean, he had gates, he had CCTV camera, he had the work, he probably everything you're told will help prevent these things. But I mean, these guys still came and targeted his farm and took his animals.
That is really frightening. No wonder people feel unsafe, you know? Like, if you've done everything you can to keep yourself, you know, kind of secure and still they're able to work their way around that, that must be really very frightening. But can I say to you, Barry, just congratulations on a great piece of investigative journalism. It's a really good story, an important story, I think, too, you know? So just thank you for bringing it to our attention, you know?
No worries. Thank you very much.
Okay, Barry Cassidy of the Irish Farmers Journal, thank you so much for talking to us this morning. God bless you, man. Our next guests have written a book highlighting numerous miracles and cures that have occurred to Irish pilgrims visiting Lourdes. Examples include recoveries from cancer, skin disease, pain, physical disability. The book is called The Village of Bernadette, Lourdes Stories, Miracles and Cures, The Irish Connection. And on the line now to tell us more, we have number one best-selling author, Colm Keane, and former RT newsreader, Una O'Higgin, two old colleagues of mine. You're very welcome to the show, Colm and Una. How are you?
Very well.
It's
less
really
of, good
to talk to you.
Less of the old
Rona. Exactly, yeah. I'm going to cut back on that for sure. So first of all, Colm and Una, what is it about Lourdes that sparked your interest to write this book together?
Well, I'll tell you very simply. Last year, we did a book about Therese of Lisieux, and everywhere we turned, we came across a story about Lourdes. And I can remember, you know, I'd say to Una, it's almost like destiny that we're going to have to do something on Lourdes. And there was a certain inevitability about that, Roland, in the sense they were both French, similar sort of era, didn't completely overlap.
Sure.
They were both young. They both became saints. They died young. And we ended up researching Lourdes, and here's the book.
And from the point of view of doing something like this together, you know, Colm and Una together, that must have been an interesting dynamic, was it?
It was, yeah. I mean, we've written two books together, so this is the third. So we've kind of got it down fairly pat. Obviously, there are strains and stresses when people are involved in the same project, but we're very lucky. We live down in County Waterford. We've got loads of beaches around us. We tend to go for long walks, and we'll talk through what we're planning to do. You know, if one of us has an idea, we'll talk about how do you begin it, how do you finish it, what's the middle, is it good enough to include in the book. So, yeah, it was I mean, it wasn't painless, but it was very enjoyable, if truth be told.
Yeah.
You know?
Brilliant. And tell us, Una, what is your process, you know, as writers? Do you both have different ways of going at it, or what way do you write separately, together? What way does it work?
No, we do it together. What we tend to do is, if I come up with an idea, I'll say to Colin, what do you think of this? And literally, we'll go for a walk and we will talk it through.
Brilliant.
Not to a minute detail,
sure.
But we'll know what approach we're taking. And if I'm, say, if I'm the one who's pushing it, I'll tend to do most of the work, and vice versa with Colm. So it's an organic process,
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, when you know each other for so long, over so long, and you know, both of you having kind of that kind of journalistic background, I'd imagine it's quite stimulating in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And it's great in a way. On occasions, I'll be the person sitting in front of the computer. Una will be beside me, nudging me, beating me up, you could almost say, Roland.
No, it's a helpful suggestion.
That's right, yeah.
Then we reverse it. And it really is a technique that works. She keeps me on my toes, I think vice versa. And the final product, I think, is better because of it.
So, Colm, I know you're saying how you arrived at this, you know, through the Fraser Lazier kind of direction, but did you know much about Lourdes before setting out to write this book?
I did. And I grew up, Ronan, in the 1950s down in County Cork. And anybody who grew up in that period knew about Lourdes. You know, 1950. Now, I was only born in 51, but it was a holy year. 1954 was a Marian year. 1958 was the 100th anniversary of the visions, the first vision in Lourdes. And there was a great devotion to Our Lady. And if you travel anywhere around Ireland today, you see these grottos. I mean, we travel a lot at the moment, and they're everywhere. And they're nearly always built back in the 1950s. So anybody in that era, and they also had, I should mention this, the bottle of holy water.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
that's right.
Pretty,
I know the one, yeah.
The blue top and the kind blue, of white
absolutely.
And Our Lady on it.
I remember
and
as well.
Any time the exam came up, out again.
That's right, yeah, exactly. Take that, it'd be put on the car and everything.
Yeah.
That's right. Una, I was just saying, like, our listenership is a real blend, you know, of Catholics and evangelicals and various different Christian denominations. So the Catholics would really know Bernadette very well. But can you just to explain to people who aren't from that kind of background who Bernadette was and what do we know about her?
Yes, her name was Bernadette Subu. She was a young girl living in Lourdes in the south of France in the shadow of the Pyrenees in the 1850s. And it's really the year 1858 that is crucial in her life. It was in February. She lived with a very poor family, very difficult family circumstances. And she herself and her sister and her sister's friend went out to collect firewood at a place called Massabielle, which was a kind of a rocky outcrop. And it was there that the other two girls went ahead. She was dragging behind. And it was there that she had her first vision of Our Lady. And there were 18 in total.
Wow, 18.
Sorry, go ahead.
I hadn't realised there was as many as 18 visions. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah, right from February until July. And probably the most important one was the ninth apparition, where the beautiful lady, as she called her, told her where there was water. She said, wash in the water and drink in it. And Bernadette discovered the Lourdes water. It was a spring that had never been known of before. But very shortly after that, miracles associated with the water and with Lourdes began to take place.
And I know that to date millions have visited the shrine, but Colm, this book focuses on Irish links to Lourdes. Can you talk us about the popularity of Lourdes with the Irish?
Yeah, well, I suppose Irish people largely, Ronan, are Catholic. You know, I mean,
sure.
Predominantly Catholic nation.
Sure.
And they were taken by Lourdes from the very beginning. Very interestingly, within 12 months, there was a man, Thomas John Capel. He was a Monsignor, and he was from Ardmore in County Waterford, and he was assigned to Poe, which is about 40 kilometres up the road from Lourdes, and he met Bernadette, and he got to know her extremely well over about 7 or 8 years, and word came back from him. It was the time as well of the electric telegraph, and news was coming back about developments at Lourdes, about the miracles and the cures. The Irish papers, if you go back to that period, they were flooded with this information, and the Irish were really attracted to it. And I think as well, Roland, if I could say, Irish people are very taken by saints and by miracles. You know, if you lose the keys of your car, St. Anthony is appealed to. If illness comes in the door, people might pray to Padre Pio. And Our Lady, of course, is very prominent. So right from the beginning, the Irish were there, they were going on pilgrimages, and they really took to Lourdes.
And there have been, have there been miracles associated specifically with Irish people?
Oh yeah, we have, in the book we have just put in about 15, maybe 12, up to 20. There are, we could have packed the book with miracles from top to bottom, but actually we decided not to, because Lourdes is about more than that. Anybody we've spoken to who's been to Lourdes talks about the serenity that you get there. And in a way, you don't have to be Catholic to go. You can be any religion or none. There's just a special quality there where you have time. You know, you're surrounded by people, there are people who are in trouble, people who are maybe very ill, but also ordinary people who are trying to get through their life. And it seems to be a wonderful meeting point for people who want to think about things other than the everyday.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've a lot of Irish miracles.
Yeah. I it's funny you say that. I worked for many years with a guy. We co-produced albums together and wrote an awful lot of TV and radio themes and stuff as well. Dave, and he was Church of Ireland. And he went out with his girlfriend one time and he came back, and like, he was used to me being the one with the faith, you know. But he came back and went, "That was an amazing place. That was beautiful." You know, it was really blown away by the place, just by the amount of, I mean, it's just incredibly prayerful, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And one of the biggest memories I have is of the torchlight procession.
Yeah.
It's one of the wonders of the world. You know, it's dusk, tens of thousands of people are holding candles and singing the Ave Maria. And it's a feeling of just togetherness, really, that you get there. I'll never forget it. Most beautiful place.
Stop. So, Colm, talk to us about the relevance you feel like, having written this book, of the relevance of a place like Lourdes today.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, if you look at it statistically, 7 million people go there every year. So it clearly is relevant to people worldwide. And when we go out, we've gone a number of times, and you go on the planes, Ryanair, Aer Lingus, and they're jammed with people. And when you walk around there, we were having fun actually, saying, oh, they're from Monaghan, they're from Galway, they're from Cork. We could pick up the accents. So it clearly is relevant to people. But the other thing is, a lot of people, Ronan, you know this too, from the program you're doing, they have problems in their lives. I mean, everybody has a problem. It can be illness, it can be death, bereavement, it can be loneliness, it can be depression, it can be anything, pressure, stress at work. And a lot of people are looking at something. And the beauty of Lourdes, quite beyond any of the symbolism or the anything, is that it allows for great introspection. You know, it's not like Las Vegas, no slot machines.
Sure.
It's not like going to London. You don't have to choose what theatre you're going to. You really can think. And you're seeing other people there, and they've got a lot of problems, and some are very clearly identifiable, and it gives you a great perspective on your own life and how well off you are, and that you shouldn't really be complaining. So I think it's got massive relevance for people today, Ron.
Absolutely. So just before I let you go, where and when is the book available?
Well, the book, I think Una has the best answer.
Well, Bernadette was canonized in 1933. Stick with me on this, because
yeah,
I'm actually
sure,
going to
sure.
answer the question.
Sure, sure. No, I'll get you. Take your time.
Loads of Irish people jammed Rome, right? So the Pope said to one of the Irish bishops, he said, "The Irish, you're like the Providence. You're everywhere." And the book is the same.
Very good. So basically, it's bookstores nationwide.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. Yeah, yeah. Good, bad, indifferent, big, small. Yeah.
Great. So it's called The Village of Bernadette: Lured Stories, Miracles, and Cures. The Irish Connection. Do we know how much it's going to cost?
$14.99.
Good. It's very, very reasonable. Very reasonable. Yeah. So I'm absolutely delighted to make contact with you guys again. Number one best-selling author Colm Keenan, former RTÉ newsreader Una O'Hagan, thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you very much, Roland.
Absolutely. So it's called The Village of Bernadette: Lured Stories, Miracles and Cures, The Irish Connection by Colm Keenan and Una O'Hagan, and it's available now in bookstores nationwide. You know what? It's been an awful long time since we've done this, but it's time for What's On, and we haven't had a What's On really section for a long time. So, Anya,
and we haven't had a Ronan and Anya like chat for a long time on air.
Probably about 5 years, in fairness. That's
at least, at least.
That's
well.
Something.
Yes, Rhoda, I was just looking at a few items that
yes,
we might
yeah,
want to
us, yeah.
take a note
What's
of
happening?
And get the diary out.
Right.
And we'll start sort of further out and then we'll work our way back in.
Brilliant.
So I know that, I believe we had Moira Brennan, haven't we?
Yeah, she was on yesterday. Yeah,
yeah
exactly.
Right, yeah. Well, Clannad are actually, they've announced Irish tour dates as part of their 50th anniversary farewell tour.
That's a frightening thought. That
Isn't
that,
can you imagine?
50th
anniversary.
Mad. Yeah.
So, yes, celebrating an exceptional award-winning 50-year career. So they're going to be performing in the Waterfront Hall in Belfast on the 29th of February, 2020.
Great.
And the Cork Opera House on the 2nd of March, 2020.
And they're two great venues. And if you haven't been to a Clannad gig, it's just mad. Actually, they're great, great fun. They literally do every kind of thing, you know. So
yeah.
In one minute, they're doing something that's complete diddly-eye. And the next minute, they're doing this kind of ethereal, kind of, you know, beautiful vocal things. And then she's playing the harp. And then they're doing something that's just purely vocal. It's really a brilliant night. Really,
well, that's how they've ended up, you know, yeah. selling 15 million records
exactly.
worldwide. Yeah.
Exactly. Surprise, surprise. Give us the dates on that again.
That's 29th of February 2020 and the 2nd of March.
So, like you say, the reason they're selling these ahead of time is because they'll go fast. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
So
and they're on sale from today.
Brilliant.
So, yep.
So, Waterfront and the Cork Opera House. Brilliant.
Yes. Now, still in February of 2020. Here's a bit of a difference. Now, we're going to the Olympia Theatre this time. And yep. it's a bit of crack. The night that Joe Dolan's car broke down.
Yeah, and you
it's
know,
been on the circuit before. It has, yeah. And it's back again, obviously, by popular demand.
Yeah.
I haven't been, but I am assured that it is very funny. So to give you a bit of a taster to it, imagine being stranded with the legendary Joe Dolan in a rural pub in Cavan on the night his car breaks down. So it's a play by written and directed by Porrig McIntyre, and it's set on a stormy St. Stephen's night as people gather to celebrate the 60th birthday party of the horse Munley.
Friends.
As the storm worsens, people head home, and anyway, the play unfolds, but it is sure to be a good night of good fun. It's in the Olympia Theatre from the 18th to the 23rd of February. So
even that says a lot, though. You know, even that says a lot. Like, you know, the way you see things happening in a little place like this for 2 and 3 nights, they've given it, you know, a kind of a week. So it's like, you know, it's proven like it's a good thing. I produced two big albums for Joe Dolan. And,
I didn't know that.
Oh, did you not? Yeah, yeah. His two return albums, the big albums at the end of the 90s. That was me. And he was hilarious.
Is that right?
One of the funniest people. So I always, you say Joe Dolan and immediately a smile comes to my face because he was such a lovely, funny man, you know, and miss him. But anyway, yes. So keep going.
Right. Okay. Dalkey Bookfest is presenting Malcolm Gladwell in the Olympia Theatre on November 29th. Malcolm Gladwell, I don't know if you'd be familiar with him, best-selling author, journalist, podcast host. He's got a new book out called Talking to Strangers. I mean, he's got 5 international bestsellers, to be fair. And this is a new book that he has out of me. How do we make sense of the unfamiliar? You know, why are we so bad at judging someone, reading a face, detecting a lie? So this is an exploration of why we so often misread other people, and he sort of takes us on a journey, and he's looking at different people, like, from, for example, there was a spy who went for years undetected at the highest levels of the Pentagon. So, you know, it's just he's such an interesting person. I think, you know, when you have these authors interviewed, they're, you know, like in a theatre, do you get a real insight into the way their mind works?
Absolutely. And you know, sometimes it's funny, isn't it? You know, they write these books about things, and then you suddenly realise that the person who's writing the book is even more interesting than the book itself.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's really well worth.
Exactly. I mean, he was named one of the 100 most influential people by Time magazine.
I had a friend who went to see him being interviewed at the book festival by, I think it was Dave McWilliams. And
okay.
They did it out in somebody's garden in the middle of the book festival. Because, like, you know, like, there's stuff going on all over the place. And they said it was just a brilliant night. So really well worth going to.
That's Friday, 29th of November in the Olympia Theatre. Now for something a little different. We're keeping with the 50th anniversaries. And this is a 50th anniversary celebration of The Carpenters.
Ah.
We've only just begun.
Wow.
Yes.
Seriously.
Starring Tony Lee as Karen Carpenter.
They're one of my guilty pleasures, The Carpenters.
Oh, I love
them.
Absolutely. Such easy listening. So, yes, so they are, so it's going to be a tour of pretty much Ireland. So they're doing Cork, they're doing the Opera House in Cork with a 30-piece orchestra.
Wow.
The INEC in Killarney, Watergate Theatre in Kilkenny, and the Bordgosh Energy Theatre, again with a 30-piece orchestra.
That's wild.
This is going to be this month, the 16th of October, Cork, 17th Killarney, 18th Kilkenny, and the 19th in Dublin.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, people of a certain age are going to love that. And actually, there's a whole rake of younger people. Like, I often would play, you know, something, and my kids are in their teens, and they'd be like, "Who? What is that? Who's that?" You know. So they actually, it's music that has survived at this really funny one. Sorry, I'm sorry for busting in on your thing there. I arrived in, and guess I used to be a regular on Dave Fanning's show, and Dave Fanning, as you know, was the rock show.
Yeah.
Was he playing one day? I arrived in, and he's playing The Carpenters, and I was. David!
The Carpenters?
What are you doing playing The Carpenters on the rock show? And he says, you know, it's really funny. I take this over Nickelback any day. He says, at least this has lasted the test of time.
Oh, absolutely.
Sounds good, you know?
There we go. 50th anniversary. Yeah. And I mean, they've sold 20,000 tickets in Ireland, plus, you know, like in their day, plus, you know, successful tours of the UK, Holland, Belgium. So it is a tribute show. So, as you know, obviously have to state that, but especially with Cork and in Dublin with a 30-piece orchestra.
Wonderful.
It'll be something else, you know.
Brilliant. So what else have you got for me?
Well, you've been talking a lot about it, I think, over the last couple of days.
Yeah,
of course, we have the opening this weekend, well, today, of Unplanned. So, that is definitely would encourage and urge everyone to go out and support it and fill those theatres and
keep
running.
Yeah, because if everybody who listens to the station goes out and watches this, it'll keep it in the cinemas for another few weeks, and it means more people get to listen in. Anya, brilliant. Great stuff. And you know what? Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Missing for a long while. It was great to have you back in studio again.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.